Welcome to the Agile Wire, where professional Scrum trainers Jeff Bubbles and Jeff Molesky discuss Agile topics. Now, here are your hosts, Jeff Bubbles and Jeff Molesky.
And we are recording. All right, Mr. Bubbles, kick us off, man.
All right, so this week on the podcast, we've got Karen Tenelius. Karen has a wide variety of background and self-management and written the book with Lisa Gill called Mooseheads on the Table. And so we're probably going to talk a lot about the book and some of the stories in there. But Karen, can you just share maybe something, you know, just some background with our listeners about self-management and kind of how you came to be, you know, one of the experts, I would say, in this field?
Yeah, it was over 20 years ago now. When I was young, I worked in the hotel industry and studied service management. And in the books, they said that to have service work, you have to involve the people giving service. And I watched everywhere in organizations, and I didn't see that theory happen in practice. Mm-hmm. So one can say my career has been like gapping that gap from theory to practice and really experience and experiment, I mean, with giving away power and authority to employees. And and it turned out amazing.
How do you get buy-in to give away the power? Like, that seems like Jeff and I have to answer this question all the time too. So I want to hear how you answer it. You know, like giving, you know, work really hard, you've worked in your career, you've built up, and now you're at this leadership level and now you can make the decisions, and now you're telling me to give all that away? Like, that seems like a really hard thing. How do you talk to people about that?
Yeah, you have to get people on board and get the point. Why should we do this? Because it's a lot of benefits for people to have power and influence. Of course, you develop, you are satisfied and everything. But what it takes is to give up control, of course. But when you try it, it's so much benefits. I mean, mm-hmm. If you want to grow businesses, for instance, that's how you do it, because you can't do everything yourself and keep it in check, sort of.
Yeah, it's kind of that worldview, like you were maybe mentioning before, of, you know, a worldview of it's okay to lose control to get cooperation and everybody kind of working together and getting alignment and working in one direction, right? Like to get that shared ownership. So giving up that control or giving up that, you know, decision-making a power like you're talking about is a big step in that. And being okay with it not being the way that you want, you know? Like, I think that's always a hard thing for some leaders, you know? Like, I really envisioned it this way and it came out this other way. And now what do I do? Like, and so how do you help leaders that are struggling with that problem?
So it depends on what you're driven by. I mean, if you want to be the central person in the universe, that's not a good idea. And if you want to be the hero manager, So it depends on what do you want to achieve also. But many entrepreneurs that I know, they want to scale, you know, and be big and have a unicorn. And then it's a very good idea to let go. And it's not about abdicating or laissez-faire or yet, you know, disappear. It's very active to support people, but the function is to support people rather than be in the light.
So can you expand on that a little bit more? You were just saying the function is to support people rather than being in the light. I would say that critical command and control structure are typical top down. So, you know, what can you dive a little bit deeper into the difference there of what you're articulating?
Yes. So it's working together with people, not running ahead or pushing people forward. So it's like engaging people in the problems, in the task, in the vision, and have them do it rather than you directing it, sort of. So it's much, I mean, we talk innovation, we talk creativity, which everyone asks for, and moving forward. And a lot of entrepreneurs also complain about being ahead and where are the others, you know, they're far behind my back. So it's a way of working where you think and work together. And that's really, you know, because we are brought up with something else, but it's very natural for a team to do that. So when you get over the first uneasiness, then it's become really, organic or natural to work like that. And nowadays people are so talented, so educated, so there's so much wisdom and competence in them, because we inherited this from factories where people weren't that skilled, you know, and we still used the same method as back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is just a little nuanced thing. There's we have a friend of ours in Conrad, and he always likes this, like watching the language that people use when they talk about like who they work with or who they work for. So if they say, I work for somebody, that means you're probably in more of a command and control type of environment where there's one leader and they're telling everybody what to do and how to do it. But if you say, I work with this person, it means more of a collaborative, cooperative, you know, kind of what we're talking about here, where there's probably more self-management going on, where people are taking on more personal ownership and decision-making. And so just that subtle, you know, nuance in language makes a big difference.
And this goes beyond working with. It's my company. It's my, you know, it's the mental ownership. Even if I don't own it by law, you know, it's people are not employed. They are sort of owners of, mental owners of this company. And imagine that power that people take out if they have that ownership.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that's come up again and again, but like, I want to feel like I'm an owner of a business. And if I am the owner, I want my employees to feel like the owners, right? Feel like they are invested in the outcomes of an organization.
Yes.
In fact, who were we talking about this with, Jeff?
Gary Hamill for sure, but I mean, it seems like we talk about it with a lot of people.
We were just talking about the investment in people, and when they feel like the owners, they're going to have a different perspective, but also in general make better business decisions because they feel like they're part of the business versus just an employee.
Exactly. And the only way I claim to do that, and that's why I realized 20 plus years ago, is to give away all the authority, to give them the whole task. You can't do it halfway because then you don't get the ownership.
Mm-hmm. So I'll give you a pushback that I would get then. Was, well, how do people know how to do that? Like, they've never had that responsibility before. How do they know how to run a business? How do they know how to make those decisions in an educated way?
Well, the learning curve is really steep, of course, but also you probably hired smart people that know something about the business or what you actually do, sort of. So if there are competence missing, it either can evolve or the team says, we need to find some guy who can do this, you know, because we lack this piece of competence. So there's no problem or challenge that the team can't solve. Maybe they can't solve it within the team, but then they can find solutions to find what they need outside.
Yeah. And I know we talked a lot about the leaders, like giving away that power, but also I think training up the people that are now getting this decision-making responsibility. And there's some ownership that goes with that, you know, okay, now I have the power to make these decisions. I want to make the best decision for the organization and for everybody that I'm working with on my team. And so there's some education that needs to be there. I mean, you know, sometimes it's financial, like how do I read a P&L statement? Like, what does this really mean? What's the difference between, you know, different accounting, you know, structures, and why do I care about that? Why does that matter? You know, there might be some of that stuff that needs to be learned, but those are all doable tasks. Like, especially at this age, I feel like a lot of people do their own taxes. A lot of people do, you know, they buy their own cars and houses and they make financial decisions all the time.
Yeah.
And so if you give them a little bit of knowledge and then teach them how to do this along the way, I think anybody can do it. It just might take a little bit of time to like gradually get them into there and give them the knowledge to make the right decisions.
Exactly. And the new competence can occur in unexpected people. So mm-hmm. they might be interested in stocks, you know, on their free time. And so it can occur where you don't expect it or in different people that don't have that formal competence even.
Yep, absolutely. And there's something different about saying, hey, Jeff, you need to learn this skill. Like, we need somebody that can learn how to, you know, code in React because we're going to build a new program that's going to use that. And me being like, hey, I've always wanted to learn that. I just haven't had the opportunity yet. And, oh, there's an opportunity. I raise my hand. I want to do it. Let me do that thing. And there's the more personal ownership and resiliency to, like, push through the hard parts when that's going to happen, when you get those new challenges.
Exactly. Yeah.
As I was thinking about this, kind of two things, and we can decide which one to kind of go after. I was kind of curious, like, what's the difference between a leader who just delegates everything? Like, is that on the road to it? Is there a difference between self-management? And because to me, that's still somebody who has control, hasn't yet given it up, but is delegating responsibility of things. And I think there's a difference there. But then my other thought that I was just kind of curious about, I already forgot it. So let's go back to that question. Like, yeah. So the difference between self-managing and somebody completely giving up the control versus a leader who's just delegating responsibility for all of these things. Is there a difference there?
Yeah, definitely. I really don't like that word delegate because it's very old-fashioned from the old paradigm where people weren't, you know, competent enough to have the big picture or solve the problem themselves. So delegating implies, you know, helping out, the being like a helper or assistant or servant or secretary or something, instead sure. of owning the whole context, sort of. So it's such a waste of capacity.
And okay, cool. So as you were talking, it made me remember the other question that I have for you. So, you know, Jeff was just outlining one of those instances where, oh, we've got a gap here, and hey, I've always wanted to learn that. I can jump in. And I don't think Jeff and I or yourself, Karen, are necessarily special people, but there's always going to be, I don't really feel like stepping up and stepping into that. When we're talking about, and what I mean by that is, some people are going to show initiative and be excited by that type of thing, and other people are going to be like, meh, that sucks. I guess there's a hole there. How much of this do you think is dependent on the individual to get their buy-in? I think we talked a little bit about it, like when you feel like you're an owner, you've got more buy-in to try to do the right things for the business. But I think there's always going to be the person who looks at it as just a job, right? This is just my day job. I come in at 9, I check out at 5, and that's how I want it to be, right? That I am not defined by my work. So, you know, I'll shut up and give you an opportunity sure. to answer.
So there's many aspects of it, but one is that people could be engaged even if they don't, you know, be there 24/7. So that's one aspect. Mm-hmm. What I have found during the years is that it's really important that people have the right job that is in line with their talent, their passion, because this way of working requires that more than ordinary workplaces. Mm-hmm. So quite often people realize that they should do something else when more requires of them, more capacity. So they find out, oh, maybe I shouldn't be in this context. But I also have learned that straightforward communication and feedback is crucial. So you have to talk about, it seems like you're not so engaged. Maybe this is not right. But on the whole, it's not so many people that end up there, much fewer than you think. But you can say that everything that is not in order occurs and emerges, so you can do something about it, including people switching functions or jobs or find a career somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah, you know, I've found in my career, you start somewhere, you go to school, you start something, you're like, I think this is what I want to do. And you're like, oh, I like this part, not this part. How do I do more of the part I like? Yeah. And then you find something else and it's like, oh, I like this type of product instead of this thing, or I like this type of role. And you keep finding that thing. So I guess there is some self-discovery that can help in there. And then maybe if you have that environment, maybe you deal with that conflict or that internal conflict dealer, yeah. and you know, sooner, and you can get that feedback to actually find sooner what you really like. But exactly. there's probably some trial and error that has to happen there.
Exactly. And this is not the Square organization when it's self-managed. It's organic. So my colleague just switched job from being in administration and doing, invoicing and stuff like that. And now she's very creative. So she sort of invented her new function that the company needed.
Yeah. And if you understand the whole company, where they're going, you can say, oh, this fits my skill set. I'm better to make that choice than somebody else that has to see that through me and, understand what I want to do. And that's a very difficult thing, I think, to happen, to find someone to see it, put you in the spot, and then you really also find the ownership to like it. So this gives a lot more opportunity probably to find the thing that you love or find something that you can be passionate about long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So thinking about one of the things that really stuck out to me when I was reading the book was so much of it was simply around coaching, right? Like many times it was I coming in as a CEO, but I'm abdicating all, like, I don't even understand this business. All right. And I'm going to rely on the people. I'm simply here as a coach. Mm-hmm. And I'm really curious, we were talking about this earlier, being outside of the bubble of the USA, is professional coaching a standard thing in Sweden or the UK or outside of our bubble in the US? Because the reason I'm asking is I've been in career for about 15 to 20 years now, and I think I've only ever encountered one professional coach, like a real life coach who was on staff, and she was only there for like a year. So one, I'm just curious, is it more mainstream in Sweden? And if so, I question stack too much. Let's just leave it there. Yeah. So is it more of a mainstream thing in Sweden?
Well, I think it's quite the same everywhere in the Western world, at least. And it's not so much coaching as a profession, as a coaching mindset everywhere. So when I support organizations to be self-managed, we train people to coach each other, not sitting in coaching sessions for ages and talk, because you don't have time to that. It's having a coaching mindset and be able to support each other without going to the manager to be supported. So it's like unleashing coaching capacity in everyone involved. And that's really good for people, you know, not only at work, because they can all of a sudden talk to their teenager at home and being a better football trainer, you know. So that skill set, which is a lot about listening and a lot about putting good questions instead of just giving advice, which people do. That's so useful in your life overall, but it doesn't sit in a coach necessarily.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I really like that. Like, coaching everywhere, it's a skill set that everyone should have. It's a common theme. Like when we're talking about teams that are cross-functional and have multiple skills, like, we talk a lot about the hard skills, you know, like they need to be able to do analysis, development, you know, UX work, database work, you know, different things like that, testing. But coaching also is another skill that, why not have that everywhere? I really like that mindset. You know, the more you have it everywhere, the more in this moment, we need it right now. I need to ask that powerful question, or I need to, you know, maybe we should reflect on this instead of just, you know, someone should just tell me what to do, you know, like, maybe why do we feel that way? You know, what structures are in place that are making us feel that way? Maybe that powerful coaching question right at the right moment helps us make the right decision at the right time. So yeah. I think that's a really good insight.
And also, like, when you want to teach someone something in the business or in school, or, you know, that the coaching mindset is really useful for giving the responsibility to the pupil or the student to take responsibility for them learning. So it's so, yeah, it's very handy.
Mm-hmm. So we go ahead, Jeff.
Really quick, I was just going to chime in. When we were talking about that delegation earlier, one of the things that always comes to mind, and I've tried to build it into my behavior, is whenever I'm like, I still am a, let's say, a top-down organization. There's still levels of that. But whenever I am working with somebody who's on a level above me, and I'm okay with that, but I'll always come in with an intent. And then, you know, I steal that from Captain David Marquez, Turn the Ship Around, that intent-based leadership. I'm a huge fan of that, just because whenever I'm thinking about an email I literally just sent last night to the CTO, it's bottom line up front. Here's my intent. Here's my proposal. This is the way that I would move forward if it was my decision. And then there's a whole heaping of information below that to sort of support what I'm thinking. And I'm always trying to think like, if I was the person in charge and I was able to make these decisions, here's the things that I would looking to be considering. And I just want to put that on a piece of paper so that he or she or whoever I'm giving this information to doesn't need to ask the question. I've already presented all the information. And that was always a big thing for me, to be thinking at that higher level. And I think what we were talking about earlier is there's lots of different ways to achieve this, right? That intent-based leadership is one way to get people to consider at a higher echelon or a higher level of visibility and impacts of their work on the organization. Another way is simply giving that all away to the actual people in a form of self-management. So I just kind of wanted to draw that correlation between the two. So anyway, Jeff, what were you going to say?
I was going to switch the topic a little bit, but now I kind of want to riff on the intent-based leadership because you brought it up. So I like that. I think even times when I'm coaching organizations, I don't know, Karen, if you have this, like I sometimes talk, I'm like, well, you're making the decision might be right, but why are you making it? And I don't know that sometimes like people are making the right decision. They're making it because they feel like this is the right thing. So the more I think we can coach and try to figure out what that intent is and ask those questions, that's another good coaching stance, I guess, a good reflection moment. Like the more you can ask that, probably the better to understand where people are coming from.
Yes. When I work with other organizations, I don't at all give them advice on what to do in their actual business. So I'm not the management consultant in that respect, which is really, you know, good, because then if I would have the responsibility for their business. So in a way, the coaching approach is very lazy, one can say.
Well, I always say we don't get our hands dirty. Like we don't actually do the work. We just help create the structures or reflect on the decision-making process or create a system that's going to hopefully, you know, help you to be a better organization.
Yeah, release their capacity, sort of their own, not ours.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So the subject I was going to kind of jump into before was the title of your book, Mooseheads on the Table. Maybe you can explain that for some of our listeners, because it's more popular saying in Sweden, but it's definitely not in the U.S. So what
is... No, you say elephant in the room, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yep. And when I started more than 20 years ago, we hadn't imported that saying yet. So, but I knew about it from, you know, movies or something. So in my version, it became moose heads on the table instead of elephant in the room, because we have mooses in Sweden. What it is about is, of course, that psychological safety and feedback culture is so crucial to have self-organized team working. So it's much more important with the culture and the working climate than in ordinary workplaces. And then you have tools to sort of develop feedback culture and psychological safety. And the one tool is moose heads. So what moose heads do we have? What are the things we don't dare to talk about? that we avoid and go around. And that's a very useful tool that we have worked, you know, with so many organizations, and they start to talk.
And so when you say it is a tool, are you using it as something to like, let's name these moose heads so like we can get them on the table?
Exactly.
And actually have to talk about them?
Yeah. And by doing that, the atmosphere shifts to a better one.
Yeah. And to draw the correlation, I don't know, of what we were just talking about before, like name it is like, I was one of my first steps that I coached people to do. And then after we name it, like what Jeff was saying, like talk about your intent, like speak from the heart. Like, what do you really want to get out of this? Like, what are we all trying to accomplish? Why are we, what outcome are we after? And if we're all after the same thing, well, now let's talk about how to get there. And we have this thing sitting here that's obviously in our way, but we haven't been talking about it. So let's go, let's, you know, dive right into it. How do you approach that when you found a moose head, it's been named, now what?
Yeah, but it's like the purpose is just to have them lose its grip. So some things you have to resolve, or resolve conflicts or misunderstandings, or put ancient incidents in the past and go on. And so it's different activities to have the moose heads lose its power, sort of, and dissolve.
So you name it, talk about it, so we understand, like, we're going to let go of these things. Maybe it's a little bit of forgiveness, you know, like, okay, that was the past. We made a mistake. Yeah. Let's move on from that. Let's, you know, if we've got scars from something, like, that's not where we are today. And so what are we going to do to move forward?
Exactly. And in that process, you also have, you hire the level of communication. So people learn how to resolve misunderstandings, and they learn how to not have fantasies about what's happening. Just ask, you did this, you know, is your intention this? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and that's when people talk on a higher level, then they will maintain a good atmosphere where people can feel at ease.
A quote I've stolen from Brené Brown is, this is the story I'm telling myself. And like, just saying that, like, I'm telling myself this story based off of this moose head or this elephant in the room. I don't know that, I feel like this isn't the truth, but this is the story I'm telling myself. And if you just kind of explain it that way, people are like, oh, no, that's not what I mean at all.
Exactly.
Here's where I'm really going.
Yeah.
And it starts that conversation in a more open way than like, Jeff, I know you're doing it because of this reason. And it becomes very accusatory.
Yes. And that goes really quickly. If you take away the surface issue, the argumentation and the right and wrong stuff, and just address the moose heads, then you can shift the atmosphere very, very fast.
Yeah, there was a siren going on in the background, so I had to mute myself for a little bit here. But those stories we tell ourselves, man, we can come up with some pretty convincing stories in our minds about why somebody is doing something, or how they're sneakily trying to stab us in the back, or whatever that happens to be. But man, we've got some wild imaginations when it comes to people. And then you just go and have a conversation with people, and then you find out, oh, it was a completely rational thing that they thought they were trying to do, or they had the best intent, and maybe something just didn't come across correctly. And I, you know, you've mentioned this a few times now, but it's going back to basic communication with people. And instead of building up, Jeff, like you were saying, that story in your head, we'll go find out what the real solution or the real story is. It just takes a little bit of courage and initiative to go and have those conversations.
Yes. And for some reason, we haven't learned so much about communication in school or whatever. So, yeah, so we're a bit, you know, not well equipped for collaboration.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you mentioned it a few times in the book, like, especially in the more traditional organizations, there's this child-parent relationship that people feel. And we want to really work towards an adult-adult relationship. And when you get to that point, that ownership takes place, you deal with the conflict, right? Because we're just two adults having a conflict, and it's okay to have conflicts. It's not bad. It's good. Like, we should have disagreements. That's how we get diverse opinions out on the table, and we can make better decisions, right?
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that? Like, what if there's a strong parent-child relationship in organizations you're working with? Like, what's your approach to that?
Yeah. So to get rid of this parent-child paradigm and have an adult-adult conversation, you have to confront as a manager that you are stuck in a traditional parent-child dynamic that everyone is trapped in. So you have to confront that. And we have learned how to take that illusion out of managers. And especially in Sweden, everyone thinks that they are coaching and involving because that's the Swedish manager style. And they're not. So we have to you know, have them wake up first. And then they have to train other ways of relating to employees and other ways of listening and communicating. And they say then, oh, this is not leadership. This is so awkward. This is so, you know, unfamiliar. And yes, it is. And then when they can see the results and the response from employees, they are amazed.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Oh, sorry. I'm optimistic with the answer to this question. Have you, talking about that coaching is kind of the Swedish way of management, have you worked with non-Swedish, so in particular US managers?
Yes, I remember one time in Charlotte or in North Carolina, right? Mm-hmm. I was there. So we travel everywhere. You know, we've been to China, we've been to Japan, we've been to the States, everywhere. And this goes beyond culture because we're all stuck in at workplaces in this hierarchical dynamics. So it's not a big difference, really. It could be more hierarchical, for instance, in Eastern Europe, Russia and Poland and so on. But on the whole, when managers can see the benefits, they become interested. And sometimes it's easier in China because they're so new to a coaching mindset. They don't know, they know that they don't know it. So they're curious and can see the benefits. So it goes beyond culture.
So cool. That was kind of the question or the answer that I was hoping for. One of the other things specifically that I would be interested for your take on was specifically for US managers versus what you think the culture is like in Sweden. Mm-hmm. Aside from just self-managing, do you think there are any like red flags or other characteristics that American type of management or hierarchical styles really just set us up for failure? Versus something you would find more mainstream in Sweden?
Yes, I think the little I've seen of US, I shouldn't talk about your country and knowing, but I can see that you have organized things in squares where you're responsible for your square, you know. Mm-hmm. And if a customer asks for something outside the square, then it could happen. It happened to me in a hotel. It's not my problem, you know, because it's uh-huh. outside of my responsibility. Whereas in Sweden, I think it has been like employees have been more responsible in the old times also. But I want also to say that even if the organizations are really hierarchical, you can, you know, be a coaching and involving manager without having a self-organized structure. So we work with huge organizations that it's not at all self-managed. And the managers become much better at thinking together, involve people, listen to people, and coach people. So it's two sort of different things. It's the paradigm and the leadership skills and the dynamics, mm-hmm. and it's the structure.
Yep. So, and then also probably the training of the people that are on the teams doing the work too, right? To take that ownership and that next step. And how do I it's being given to me, but is it really being given to me? Because I think a lot of times they've been told in the past, like, oh, this is a new thing we're doing. You're going to have more ownership. And then it gets pulled, the rug gets pulled out from underneath them. And they're like, wait, now we're back to just what we did before. So I think there is, you know, three prongs there. You know, it's the leaders, the people doing the work, and the structures that we put in place to allow for self-management to really occur. And I think you hit the nail on the head there. Like, it's not so much about the efficiency of the task that's being done as it is about a mindset of solving a problem for our customer. And so getting aligned around that is also a really important structure that needs to be put in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As soon as, like, I could feel like inside, like, yep. I can totally see that. We talk about fiefdoms. We talk about specialities. But even from the customer perspective, like, not only is it kind of a crappy experience, but there's a delay in the system. As soon as you said, well, it's not my problem, you got to go over here and talk with Joe. Joe can help you with that. Well, there's a handoff, right? We've lost knowledge. Now we have to explain to Joe the situation and why are we sending the customer over to you? We talk about it quite a bit, but there's just more waste that we're introducing when we go down this route of specialties and confining people to just operate within these little boxes. And oftentimes we fool ourselves into thinking that's the efficient way of working is yes. Joe is the expert at X. So everything that has to do with X, we send it over to Joe. But we're actually introducing fragility into our system. We're introducing delays for our customer. And we're really limiting the individuals to grow outside of the boxes now that we've constructed for them. So just kind of interesting there. The differences. So I'm glad we had an opportunity to highlight that.
Yeah. And instead of having one person have a square, a whole team could have responsibility. So it's not like everyone is responsible for everything in self-managed organization, because that's not efficient either. So it's really clear that what the team's function is, for instance. But on top of having that responsibility, you also have the responsibility of the whole company. So if you see another team failing, you have to sort of say something about that.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Like, that's the next step. So you're a leader, you've given away some stuff, some decision-making power, different things. You've got people aligned around solving a problem, right? Now they're doing that. And now you're like, what's the next step? And so I think the next step, like you just were saying, is like, well, step back, look and say, what structures are in place that are putting a culture that is the opposite of what I want, or promote certain behaviors that I don't like? What culture or what structures could we put in place to change that? Is there education we need to do? What's the next step to change the culture to what you want it to be? And I know you talk a lot in the book about being like a culture protector and like a steward of the culture. So maybe you can talk a little, I don't know, maybe share some examples of that. I'd love to hear, you know, how have you done that in the past? Yeah. How have you been that steward?
When you talk, I think, I just came to think, you make everyone whistleblowers, sort of. Mm-hmm. So whistleblowers are, of course, people that are really committed to have it in a working way. And if you make everyone that giving that mandate, and not only the mandate, but also the duty to whistle when it's not on track. That's really like an open atmosphere of feedback and having a say when things are not as they should be.
Right. By doing that, you're going to get earlier transparency, allowing you to inspect and adapt and change sooner, right? Instead of going down this path for months to years and making bad decisions continuously, you'll reduce your risk and hopefully, you know, be able to pivot quicker and make better decisions and do the best thing for your customers and hopefully then the best thing for the organization as well. So
yeah,
I like that.
And you create really robust and strong organizations that don't depend on a few.
Hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. We get asked all the time, like, how do you scale an organization? And it's usually in organizations like we were talking about before that are maybe a little more hierarchical than others. It's like, well, you wouldn't really be worrying too much about scaling if you just had everybody that was an owner and could make decisions. Like, it's like, cool, we have 12 people on this team. Let's split into 2 6-person teams and hire a couple more people and get them to be just like everybody else. And then you just do it, keep doing it. You know, like, it's a pretty simple model, you know?
Yeah. I know two guys, Swedish guys, that created an IT company in Ukraine. called Beetroot, and they are 500 people now, totally self-organized. And they say, we would never have succeeded in scaling like this without being self-organized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or like, So tell, do you know a little bit more about how they actually got to 500? Like, how did they go from a few to the numbers they're at?
They started 2012, I think, and they came from Sweden via Russia with an old Russian car, and they hired a room and they slept under the work desk. And then they just hired people. And now they actually have made an impact in Ukraine because they make students employable in the tech industry. So that's what they do. And they just attract so many people that wants to work in this way. Mm-hmm. And they are in the middle of a very hierarchical society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I sometimes get pushback when I talk with leaders about this, like, well, there's people that just don't know how to do this, or our team doesn't understand how to work in a self-managed way. And I'm like, well, create that structure, start teaching them, and you're going to attract more people that want to work that way. Like, you're unique if you're doing that. Like, that is not the mainstream way of working, and you're going to get all the people that want to work and be owners. They want to take the ownership. They want to take it to that level. They're going to be attracted to your company, and that's going to give you an advantage over every other company. So, exactly. Yeah, I like the way you call that out. And it also gives them skills too. Like, I always think, like, when people ask, like, well, what's in it for me? And it's like, well, you're getting new skills that are going to be with you for life. Like, no matter what you do and decide to do, you're getting new skills, and and that's helping you personally. So even if the financial benefits aren't there, because some organizations don't put that in place right away, or you don't align the ownership, like, you're still gaining skills that are going to make you a better person and a better employee somewhere else, or an owner of a new company, maybe in the future.
It's very attractive for people to work this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, Jeff, one of the companies that we used to work for a while ago, it certainly wasn't self-managing, but I think the leadership did a really good job of bringing everybody into the business mindset there. And, you know, that was one of the first areas where I got experience looking at a P&L sheet. I started understanding the difference between, like, bookings and accounts receivable, and the delay between when we bill a customer and the money actually hits the books on our side, and how that affects the business. And, you know, I just distinctly remember, and I'll give a shout out, like, Chris Hayes and Jake Scherer at the time. These were people who they were open to bringing people in to the conversation and helping educate them for anybody who was interested. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what we've been talking about is just building that investment in your people, because they're going to make better business decisions when they have it there. And part of why I'm saying this is I just feel like we, Jeff and I, like, we were really fortunate to get to work for an organization who would do that for us. I don't think, I'll speak for myself personally, there's no way I would be in the same position that I am today if I wasn't in an environment and a culture that was that saw somebody who wanted to take initiative and gave them the opportunity to do so. I would still very much just be an order taker with my career. So you were talking earlier, Karen, about, you know, that coaching environment. And in my terms, I think about it as a force multiplier, right? Like, what are the things that we're doing that are building not just our organizations up, but our team members up, long-term success, not just here right now today, but 5, 10, 20 years into the future. I'm a totally different person because I was given these opportunities 15 years ago at that company. And you're just saying, like, well, why don't we just do that all over the place? Like, think about not just our business, but our cultures, our humanity for all of that, right? Like, that's the right direction to be thinking. I'm trying not to go all, you know, meta here with it, but, like, this is a really powerful thing, and it's almost a detriment to your coworkers or anybody else to be held back in this old command and control, top down hierarchical system that we've had in place for so long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I agree totally. And there's so much personal growth, you know, which is a side effect, one can say. Mm-hmm. So when we had this call center, I describe in the book, people were learning so much and making really brave decisions about their lives also as a complete side effect of running a call center.
Yeah, and feedback you might have got from some people during that time is like, well, what if they leave the call center? Now we've taught them all these new skills and they're going to go somewhere else. And you're like, well, good. Hopefully they help society and they're better prepared and better people and better for it. You know, like, Jeff, you just made me think of that saying you say all the time of, you know, rising tides raise all ships. And if everything raises, everyone's going to be influenced by that. And so I think that's just a great way to make positive change in the world.
Yeah. And I think people also say when they work in places like this, they don't want to work anywhere else. So quite few mm-hmm. leaves because they couldn't imagine to go back to some old-fashioned top-down thing.
Yep. There's organizations that Jeff and I've worked with where, you know, we've gone in and we help them use Scrum, which is, you know, a framework for building complex problems and solving complex problems. And there's a lot of self-management that goes into that. And after they've done that for a while, you know, sometimes I'll ask, and this is usually my measure of success, like, well, what if, you know, company B over here wanted to hire you for like another $10,000 a year? Like, would you go there? But it's the old way that you used to work. It's very traditional, top down. You're going to be given orders. You have no control over what happens, but you get paid more money. Would you take that job? And they're like, heck no. Like, it would take a lot more money than that. Like, I don't know if I'd ever do that, even for the whatever money you would throw at me. So if you get to that point, then the people have seen the light. They seem like there is a better way. And I think that, you know, that happiness comes with that.
Yeah.
Way of working. Awesome. So Karen, it's been a really great conversation. Jeff and I really enjoyed it. Is there anything you want to plug to our listeners? Anything you want to promote? Any conferences you're talking at or any ways that our listeners can connect with you after the podcast?
I'm thinking about Lisa Gill, my co-writer. Yep. She has this podcast, Leadermorphosis, with really great episodes and also Tough Leadership Training. We have free webinars that you can, it's called Stop Motivating Your Employees. And you can check it out on our web page. But I just want to encourage all of you to just find your way, because there is no, you know, certain way. It's just to try out those mm-hmm. ideas and do it.
Yes. It's a journey. There's not one way to move into self-management. You have to learn through doing, just like you were talking about in the very beginning of the podcast. That's awesome.
Thank you for listening to The Agile Wire. We are consistently inspecting and adapting ourselves. We would appreciate feedback at feedback@theagilewire.com or on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play Store. See you next time.